Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
It was 3 weeks ago today that a shooter forced his way into Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. It took just a few minutes, and Adam Lanza had killed 20 children, 6 teachers and staff, and then took his own life. He had already killed his mother at their nearby home. Today, former Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords is meeting families in Newtown. She's still recovering from being shot 2 years ago in another mass shooting when Jared Loughner opened fire and killed 6 people. We're going to spend some time today talking about Newtown and other mass shootings with author Andrew Solomon. He studied family differences, and he tried to determine why people commit these crimes. His sprawling book is titled Far From the Tree: Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. And Andrew joins us from New York. Welcome.
What a pleasure to be here.
Well, Andrew, your book touched on a lot of themes of families coping with unexpected differences. You write about families of autistic children, families dealing with members who have schizophrenia, and one chapter was devoted to families dealing with crime. After Newtown, you were called on to give your insights because of that. And in a New York Times op-ed piece, you wrote that the reason behind these kinds of violent crimes is unknowable.
I think that we have a tendency, whenever there's been a crime, to try to compensate for that exact kind of crime and to try to prevent that exact kind of crime. So someone tried to blow up an airplane with a shoe bomb, and now we all take our shoes off at the airport. But I think that this kind of violence is somewhat random. I think it grows out of very complicated and difficult to discern questions of mental imbalance or mental illness. And I think that knowing how to prevent the thing that just happened doesn't empower us to prevent the next bad thing that will happen. I think these things come apparently out of nowhere, and that it's very difficult to predict them or to be prepared for them.
But still, there is that complicated set of mental health issues that may have been involved, and as we want to search for why, so we can understand, maybe to prevent, maybe to understand. You did look at Columbine, the shooting in 1999 in Colorado, and over an 8-year period, you spent hundreds of hours with Tom and Sue Klebold, the parents of Dylan Klebold. He was one of the Columbine shooters. And what did you find from that story?
You know, before I met Tom and Sue, I thought that when I went out and spent time with them and spent time in their house and in their community, that I would come to understand what had happened and that I would get to know these parents and I would see what the flaws were in the way that they had brought their children up. And I would be able to say, ah, yes, this is what they did wrong and this is why it happened. And the more time I spent with them, the more bewildered I was. They're kind, moral, admirable people whom I would have been very happy to have as my own parents and who would, there is no question in my mind, have leapt into action if they'd had the slightest notion that their son was even capable of doing something like what he did. And I ended up finding the conversations with them very compelling and very moving, but I found that the underlying theme of them was how unknowable their own child had been to them. So at the end of the first long weekend that we spent doing interviews, I said to them, if Dylan were here now, do you have any sense of what you'd want to ask him? And his father said, I sure do. I'd want to ask him what the hell he thought he was doing. And his mother kind of looked at the floor, and she thought for a second, and then she said, I would ask him to forgive me for being his mother and never knowing what was going on inside his head. And I heard that theme over and over again as I worked on the chapter. There was another family I interviewed who had a son who had committed crimes slightly less atrocious than Columbine, but very serious crimes nonetheless. And I was talking to the mother, and I asked her for an explanation of something, and she shook her head, and she and I had met 2 weeks earlier, and she said, frankly, Andrew, I know you better than I know my son.
What was it about the unknowability here? I mean, was it parents not really knowing their kids because they were afraid to intrude in their teenage lives and they thought that they were becoming independent, so they needed to back off? Was it denying that there was a problem, or at least a really bad problem? I mean, what made these people so unknowable even to their own families?
I've seen all of those things in operation. There are certainly families who are in denial. There are certainly families whose children have severe problems and who keep trying to overlook them. In the case of the Klebolds, I think their son was very secretive. And I think most adolescents are secretive. And I think parents have to really steer between intrusiveness and neglect. I think his parents really didn't have a clue, and I think they didn't have a clue because he was really trying to keep the knowledge away from them.
But one thing that you mentioned, and maybe this is just me looking for the thread like everyone else is here, but one thing that I did notice that you mentioned in the chapter is sort of a lack of intimacy or an inability to be very demonstrative in affection. Is this at least somewhat of a common thread among the parents that you've spoken with?
I really found that the experience of the parents I spoke with varied enormously, so it's difficult to pull out anything and say that it's a common thread. But I do think that one of the best defenses against this kind of horror is to insist on a certain measure of intimacy, and that while one wants to allow one's adolescent children privacy, it's also important to do one's best to know them and to make them feel that they are known. I don't know that that's enough to prevent tragedies. These episodes, Newtown and Columbine, represent something so extreme, so aberrant, and so awful as to be almost incomprehensible. You know, we've all felt from time to time a certain degree of what I suppose would be murderous rage. We've all occasionally felt as though we have a compelling need to own something that isn't ours, and the wish to steal it may have lit up in us. Most of us have never felt like we wanted to go in and murder 26 children in a classroom or to blow up an entire school. It's such extreme behavior that we don't look for it. We look for adolescents to behave in a somewhat aberrant way, but it would never cross most parents' mind that their child was capable of something as extreme as this.
We're speaking with author Andrew Solomon. He wrote the book Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. And we're talking with him about the Newtown, Connecticut massacre and what's happened there. And he had spent time with the parents of Dylan Klebold, one of the shooters involved in the Columbine massacre in 1999. Andrew Solomon, I'm wondering, though, from your experience with the Klebolds, with Dylan Klebold's parents, did there or were there, in retrospect, any warning signs for them? You write that at one point Dylan Klebold was arrested for breaking into a car. He was sent to a diversion program which administered psychological tests and found that nothing was wrong. But were there things going on with him that his parents now say, maybe we could have handled that differently?
There was a long period of time when we assumed that parents were somehow responsible for pretty much all of their children's differences or problems. So we thought that if kids were gay, it was because they had overbearing mothers and passive fathers. We thought if kids were autistic, it was because they had refrigerator mothers. We thought if they had schizophrenia, it was because their parents nurtured an unconscious wish so that they not exist. And we tended to blame parents a lot of the time for these problems. If you go back 200 years, there was a current theory in which a child's dwarfism or deformity was caused by the mother's lascivious longing. And we've sort of dropped that blaming the parents routine on almost everything, but we still have it when it comes to criminality. And there are some parents whose abuse or neglect has severely exacerbated their children's criminality and really is responsible for it in some way. But there are many cases in which it's a thing that has occurred as randomly as autism appears to occur and is very difficult to explain. When you ask about looking retrospectively at Dylan Klebold, sure, there are things that you look at in retrospect and you think, that was a little strange that he did that. But I don't think they're very extreme or noticeable. I mean, I watched a video with his parents that was taken of him on his way to the prom 3 days before the shooting. And I thought, he seems a little truculent a couple of times here. He seems a little irritable with his parents. But irritable with his parents doesn't seem that strange in a 17-year-old. And I think it's a little like the post 9/11 question that we say, oh, but look, there was this material that was overlooked by investigative agencies. And there was, and it's terrible that it was overlooked, but there's so much noise. There are so many people making threats that don't materialize, and it's difficult to know which ones to pay attention to. So from what I saw on the videos of Dylan, would I have thought he was going to blow up the school? No. Now that he's blown up the school, when I look at those videos, is there stuff in them? And I think, it's a little disturbing the way he says that.
Now, the Klebolds stayed in that same community in Colorado. Why?
When I first went out to see them, I was sort of bewildered by that. And I said, surely you wanted to get away from here and from all of this. And his parents said, you know, if we'd settled someplace else, everyone who met us would have met us as the parents of that killer. Whereas here, there were people we'd known for many years who loved us. And his mother said, most important, there were people who'd loved Dylan. And part of what came out of my conversation with them and out of this larger investigation of criminality is that it's very comforting to think that there are people who are terrible and evil and that the rest of us are not like them and that they represent an alien class of people who are hardly people at all. But in fact, most of the people I met who had committed atrocious crimes had also committed acts of great kindness from time to time. And dealing with that nuanced reality that these people were not obviously and completely monstrous at all times, but rather were capable of sweetness and then turned out to be capable of this horror, the horror drowns out the sweetness. I mean, I'm not saying that we have to now say, you know, what a lovely fellow Adam Lanza was by any means. I'm just saying that it's hard to read, and it's important for the parents often to be able to hold on to the complex, nuanced reality of their child, even after their previous perception of him has been utterly undermined by such an extreme act.
And you got pretty close with the Klebolds. You stayed in Dylan's old room when you visited. You spent hours and hours with them.
And I kept thinking that if I spent more time with them, it would all get clearer, and it didn't. But I also wanted to understand their emotional journey since the tragedy. And I ended up thinking, okay, there's a common perception that somehow these other children were murdered and those lives had value and those children were innocent. And because of what Dylan did, the fact that he killed himself at the end of it doesn't really count for much. And I ended up thinking, these are parents, and despite what their child has done, they love their child, and they've had the devastating experience of losing not only their child himself, but also everything they believed about him, and in some ways, by extension, everything they believed about themselves. And so I came to see their experience as one of enormous pain and enormous, almost Greek-level tragedy.
And how do they cope with something like that?
I think Dylan's father has attempted to move on. He said, what happened is horrific, but we need to keep going with our lives despite that. And I think his mother, Sue, has investigated and plumbed and reviewed and tried and tried and tried to make sense of it. And she said to me, even quite recently, and the event was a long time ago, she said, I get in the car to go to work and I cry all the way there. And then I get to work and pull myself together and function through the day. And then I get in the car and I cry all the way home. The pain and the horror, she said, of what happened, and my pain for these other families, and the idea that I created someone who was capable of inflicting that much pain on that many people. I mean, it's been a terrible thing for her in terms of herself, and I think she's also suffered a lot for those families. And she said, I would do anything to help the families of the victims. You know, and when we look at Newtown, to which we're drawing these parallels, I just think, okay, presumably if Adam Lanza's mother had known that her son was capable of killing her, she would have taken some measures to prevent it. There has to have been an unawareness there for that to have transpired.
Andrew Solomon is author of Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. We're talking about what, if anything, we can learn from mass shootings. We'll have more with Andrew in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation about what we might learn from past mass shootings and the massacre in Newtown, Connecticut, 3 weeks ago today. Our guest is Andrew Solomon. He's author of Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. And Andrew, you've written about what you say is a continuum of the shooters in mass killings, going from Dylan Klebold, the Columbine shooter, to Jared Loughner, who shot former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords and killed six others. Can you explain what you mean by a continuum?
Jared Loughner had diagnosable schizophrenia, and he was clearly completely crazy and dysfunctional. Months before the shooting in Arizona took place, one of his classmates wrote in an email, which was then picked up and quoted in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere, there's a crazy kid in our class. He's the kind of person who comes in one day and shoots up the whole classroom. I'm completely terrified of him. So everyone saw that there was something very bizarre going on there, and no one did anything about it. Dylan Klebold was incredibly secretive, and as I've said, if you look at a video of him taken 3 days before the event, you would never guess what was going to happen. What I've said is that we really have failed as a society in two different ways. One is to have the tools and the skills to be able to penetrate the extreme secrecy of someone like Dylan Klebold. But the other is that in cutting back mental health services and ignoring the problems of people with severe mental illness, and to some degree in curtailing the extent to which people can be subjected to involuntary commitments, we've ended up neglecting to take care of people who are capable in a state of really advanced craziness of doing terrible and destructive things. And I think the dismantling of a great deal of the mental health system in the United States has been horrific for the people with mental illness who suffer terribly and needlessly without treatment, but it's pretty horrific for the rest of us when someone like Jared Loughner is free to seem totally crazy, totally full of rage, totally bent on destroying the world, and just left to keep going that way without anyone intervening in any way.
In the New York Times op-ed piece that you wrote after Newtown, you said that to stem violence, we have to stem despair. What do you mean by that?
I felt as I read Dylan Klebold's writings and Eric Harris's writings, Eric being the other perpetrator of the Columbine Massacre, that they really were very different in tone. Eric had, he was grandiose, he had an idea that he should really be running the world, and he was very set on homicide. And Dylan's writing is very depressive, and though he was certainly culpable in the homicides and had recorded these tapes that showed his most hateful side, the mechanism of his engagement with this whole project was suicidality. He experienced enormous despair, and he wanted to die. And Carl Menninger famously said that the wish to commit suicide involves the wish to kill, the wish to be killed, and the wish to die, and that those are three separate wishes. And I felt reading Dylan's writings, I thought, if he had not been so depressed, if he had not wanted to die, he wouldn't have ended up killing all these other people. And about Adam Lanza in Newtown, I just said, you can't overlook the fact that this was a murder-suicide, that he not only killed all of these other people, but also killed himself. Now, we are reasonably much more upset about his killing all these other people than his killing himself. But that being said, when you try to figure out why he did it, you have to think to yourself, he also was killing himself. And where was all that hatred originating? It was probably originating in self-hatred. This was someone who needed to die himself and was so angry about those feelings that he decided to pull a lot of others with him.
Now, in Newtown, in the Newtown case, the medical examiner there has asked geneticists at the University of Connecticut to study Adam Lanza's DNA for any biological clues. What do we know about biology here, or do you think that this is another attempt to try to, you know, pin down some definitive answers?
I think the idea that we'll somehow find the gene in Adam Lanza that is a single gene that explains this whole thing is naive. I mean, there was someone I was talking to in another context about the human brain, and I said to him, how do you detect certain personality qualities in the brain? And he said, at the moment, the images we have of the brain are like those pictures that were taken of Earth by the first astronauts who went to the moon. You can see the clouds, you can see the weather systems, you can see the continents and the oceans. He said, when you can read the numbers on the license plates, we'll understand what causes this kind of behavior.
You know, if we just go back to the New York Times op-ed piece that you wrote, you said, those who make comprehension the precondition of acceptance destine themselves to unremitting misery. Does that mean that we're just doomed to see these things repeat themselves and there's really nothing we can do?
No, it doesn't mean that at all. We can prevent the kind of things that happened with Jared Loughner by working on providing better mental health services. We might be able to prevent what happened with Dylan Klebold and Adam Lanza by having mental health screenings starting at an early age so that the depression that probably came first in both of those cases could be detected earlier on and sooner. And I think we need to recognize that much as we may love our children, everyone is capable of acts of extreme destruction. So I will be a different parent to my children through having studied these cases than I would have been otherwise. I recognize that they might someday be capable of doing something really terrible and that I have to be awake to that and vigilant about it and not be convinced that because they're my children and I love them so much, they could never do anything like this. And that, I think, was really the lesson I took from this, was it doesn't cross parents' minds that their children are capable of such things. And It needs to cross parents' minds. Finally, the thing that we can do that I myself think is most urgent is we can restrict access to the means to commit these kinds of crimes. When people who are suicidal and want to kill themselves can't get their hands on a gun so fast, they frequently think better of it. And I believe that if they couldn't get their hands on a gun so fast, they might also think better of going in and shooting up a whole school or a whole classroom full of little children. And that if we were to restrict access to guns and we were to restrict access to other means of destruction, we would go a long way toward containing this kind of event.
Andrew Solomon, author of Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. To read an excerpt, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Andrew, thanks very much for being with us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
And this note, this weekend marks one of the first gun shows to be held in the Newtown area since the tragedy. Others have been canceled. The organizer says vendors will use common sense to screen out potential gun buyers with mental health problems. What do you think about the lessons to be learned from Newtown? Tell us at hereandnow.org. News is next. Here and Now.